You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is another podcast recorded live at this year's Edinburgh Festival at the Gilded Balloon. This is a fascinating chat with Josh Widdicombe. Hello. Hi. Hello, Josh. I remembered to stay standing up that time until you came on. It's kind of good host manners.
Oh, God. So, terrible microphone technique to start.
Yeah, shocking. So we've got absolutely loads to talk about. You and I know each other quite well, and
yes,
we've seen each other gig a lot. I've seen your work a lot, and I remember when you did Show Me the So You Think You're Funny. Which year was that? When did you do that?
2008.
2008.
It was quite a good final. I lost in the final, but I mean, I'm loath to use the phrase vintage year, but...
go on. Who was it? Who was it in year?
The final was me, Sarah Pascoe, Sean Walsh, Doc Brown, Daniel Sloss, and Daniel Simonson won, and there'd have been some other people whose name escapes me.
Yeah. And those people will be listening to this Rona on podcast Cameron, and grinding their teeth.
Yeah, yeah. Rona Cameron, who... had a horrible evening.
She hosted. It's traditionally the person that hosts the final of So You Think You're Funny has a really horrible time, because normally they get a name, they get a famous comedian to come and do it who doesn't really host anymore, and they've got to do one of the hardest jobs in comparing, which is like do tiny sections in between very short 7-minute sets.
Yeah,
I've seen Ardlo Hanlon do it, and
it was quite weird because she was having to be comforted by her girlfriend while we were going through what we thought was the biggest gig of our life, and what obviously turns out later doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I remember afterwards you actually came up to me and asked me for advice.
Did
on
I?
Being a comedian.
Well,
yes.
I don't know if you... Do you know the first gig I did with you?
Which one was that?
I did a support slot on... a Kiosk of Champions preview in the old coffee house in Soho.
Ah, oh, I remember it. I remember it. Kiosk of Champions was my old double act.
Yeah, it was me and Holly Walsh.
Yeah.
And I thought, had I been going about 4 or 5 months? I thought, this is a big deal. Mainly because I was quite intimidated by Holly Walsh.
Yes. Well, Holly Walsh is more so, she's sort of my year at school, isn't she? We did the competitions. It's easy to think, because of the competitions and the way they work in stand-up comedy, that the people who do all the big competitions with you that year or year after is kind of your gang.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, my gang is, what, Acaster, Helm?
Yes.
Kumar. Yes. It's weird.
Yeah. So tell us about your show. I've not seen your show this year. I think we clash. I can't actually see
it. It's fine.
So just by way of introduction to the few people
that's
here who won't have...
totally fine. It's basically an hour of, well, 50 minutes, let's not beat around the bush, which I think's too long anyway, but that's another debate. I think Edinburgh shows are too long, but
let's
40
jump
minutes.
On that. 40 minutes. That's a long stand-up set, isn't it?
I've never been in an Edinburgh show where I haven't checked my watch.
Yeah.
And I've never been in an Edinburgh show where at the end I haven't thought, thank fuck that is over. And that's no reflection on any of the Edinburgh shows.
Sure.
Like the best things I've seen, like the mince pie one, the Rod
yes.
did. That's still you're going, this is too long for me to sit
yes.
and watch.
Josh is a young person. And, this year it's called The Further Adventures.
Yeah, which is a generic choice of title because it isn't about anything.
It's a good move to do a generic title that you're then, in the writing of the show, completely free to do whatever you want.
Yeah, because essentially I'm not writing a show. I'm writing stand-up and then I'll have 50 minutes of stand-up. And I will make that into a show, but it's not a show in the Edinburgh sense. It's a 50-minute set.
Yes,
which is what I do. And it's kind of, you know, it's when I used to watch. When I was a kid, I had the Frank Skinner Live in Birmingham video mm-hmm. that I used to watch again and again till it did that thing where
it goes all fuzzy and fades out.
Yeah,
like most people did that with porn, didn't they?
Yes. thanks. I it's just a long set. I'm happy just to do a set like that's all I can really do is stand up. Mm-hmm. I haven't got anything to say.
Okay, so there's no you've never written to a theme?
No.
So how do you start finding material from scratch? Like with my show this year, I thought I want to do a show about selfishness. And I started writing things about
selfishness. That's a good way
and
to do it.
Well, it was very hard and painful and difficult, and maybe it isn't a good way to do it. But so how do you stumble upon a starting point?
I'll write throughout the year from September, mm-hmm. And just try and I'll get an idea. So or think of a. It's quite a good way is just to think of a topic mm-hmm. that hasn't been touched on and think is there anything to say about that.
Very hard to find topics that haven't been touched on.
Yeah.
Very hard to know whether a topic that you've thought hasn't been touched on and that you've been beavering away with hasn't been done on someone's... Steve Bennett is always very keen to point out, well, of course, Emo Phillips covered this extensively 15 years ago.
Yes. Is he? Well, that's worrying. you get a topic. Often, the material I start... What the topic I start with won't be what it is...
Yes,
at the end.
Okay.
So, for instance, say in this year's show, there is a bit about board games.
Okay.
So that started because I thought about when you go into a pub and they've got board games, and mm-hmm. I thought that's kind of it's just a weird juxtaposition. So there's probably something in that, and then you start to write about it, and then I think what I regretted a bit from the last year's show mm-hmm. was once you've done a topic. You can't go back to it. I'm not going to waste my time improving bits that are in last year's show.
Yes. Okay.
So
it does that, so doesn't it? Edinburgh sort of ruins material, doesn't it, by going that's finished now. You've done.
Yeah.
It.
I've only got so much time. I'm not going to go and do the. For instance, there's a good example is there's a bit I've got about 2p pushing machines on piers.
Yes.
And it's got a couple of other bits about the dance machines you get in arcades and. Mm-hmm. Those racing, plastic horse racing that you bet on. And that's probably the best bit I had in last year's show. And I was walking around an arcade in September thinking, there's so much more I could say about this, but there's no point now.
Yeah, you don't want to be the arcade guy.
No,
which comes back in 2012 with even more stuff.
So for instance, this year, the board games thing, I've just like, right, get everything I can about board games because this is the one chance to do a bit on board games.
Okay.
And so just trying to amass it and make it bigger and bigger. Because I like bits where I really like it when a comedian will rinse a topic. Like Seinfeld's excellent at that. Like he's got that bit about Halloween and it's everything you want to say about Halloween.
Yes. You get the impression that the 20 jokes you're hearing are the best 20 of 1,000 jokes that he wrote about Halloween.
And so it's just topics, really. Get the topic, and then and that topic can come from either one observation, and you think, well, I've got a joke on that, so I might as well write around that. So, for instance, oh, God.
For the benefit of the listener, it's quite early.
Yeah. For instance, I've got a bit about... this is a good example. I've got a bit about Coco Pops, right? And so you go, well, I've got this joke about... I don't know if you've had the situation where a cash point asked me if I wanted Coco Pops. So I thought, I'll start writing about that. And then you think, well, I can write about other things there. So I've got, I can write about variety packs. I can write about...
Yes.
Breakfast buffet. Other stuff that is related to that comes off it. And you, it can just be one joke that you start with. Mm-hmm. And then you go, well, I might as well mine this area.
Yes, because you've got that joke.
Yeah, and often that joke will then not end up in the bit.
Okay. Do you find... I sometimes find when I'm writing stuff, if I get a punchline that I know is funny enough that I can... it can buy me out of a bit of dicking around. I can kind of... I've got that punchline, so I can put... Do you put the newer stuff to add to it? Do you put that before you get to that punchline because it'll save you if it doesn't work? Or do you put it after?
When I'm trying the stuff out, I will... Well, if I've got a bit that knows I know works... No, do you know what? I'll tend to do it in the other way.
Okay.
Because if I'm trying something out, I don't... I do obviously care if I fuck the gig, but if... I'll start with the stronger stuff and then I'll bolt the other stuff on and attempt to keep doing that until I just have completely fucked the bit up. And then,
okay.
And then... but that's how I find it. And then it's just slowly making it bigger and making it bigger.
Sure.
And... I'm not very good at remembering stuff, so it'll often take me 3 gigs to try all the bits. Because if someone like James Acaster will, he's very good at nailing of delivering new stuff as if it's old.
Yes,
I'm not very good at that.
Yeah, okay.
I will almost always deliver it too fast, which is because you're nervous because you don't know where the laughs are,
mm-hmm.
so you'll speed through it and. It will slow down as you get more confident with it.
Yes. Yes, that's... I think I've heard that secondhand from Al Murray. I'm sure someone said, Al Murray's thing is always slow down. However slow you're going, slow down.
But it's almost impossible to.
Yeah, yeah.
I think.
So this is Josh Widdicombe. As I said, this one's obviously recorded live in Edinburgh and also features later on the vocal talents of Mr. Nish Kumar. Josh is an incredible actor. He has an enviable talent and he's also found his voice very early on in his career, I think. We'll be talking about his work ethic. We'll be talking about the relationship between himself, his self and his persona, and nature of character and the change in that character that the circuit affords you or sometimes doesn't. We'll be talking about the struggle for originality in a world, the world of observational comedy, where sometimes it can seem like everything's already been said. And we'll be talking about how it can help or sometimes not if somebody can do an impression of you. So lots of stuff to get through here. And of course, there'll be some thoughts on coping with it all. This is one of my all-time favourite episodes, to be honest. Josh is so articulate. And he really cares about his comedy. He's a real thinker, but he manages not to be overwrought, as can happen to a lot of thinkers. He seems a very functional person, a very functional comedian, if such a thing exists. So, I hope you enjoy it. I really enjoyed this this interview. Shall I keep knocking these out weekly? Is it too much? I don't want to drown you. I quite liked before when you had to wait 2 weeks to get the next one. Email me and let me know. It's info@comedianscomedian.com. I'm just sort of making this up as I go along. So if you've got strong feelings either way, do say so. I sort of don't want to get to a stage where you don't get round to listening to them because there's, you know, there's too many available. If that's a thing that happens, is that maybe that's just a thing that that happens to me. My own gig list is now up and running. If you'd like to come and see me do some stand-up, you can go to www.stuartgoldsmith.co.uk and follow the link to the gig diary. Although I am very pleased to announce that I am going to Australia and New Zealand next year. I'm very lucky to be going to the Adelaide, Melbourne and New Zealand comedy festivals. So if you have any recommendations of other shows that you know are going to be there or things I should do while I'm out there, do tell me. If you could recommend particularly Australian or New Zealandish acts or any international acts that are going to be at those festivals that you'd particularly like to hear from, I shall be out there with my trusty hand recorder. And so get your. I'll start writing a list from now, so get your recommendations in for that. Of course, comedianscomedian.com/newhack is up and running. Here are some of my current favourites. That's a thing, right? Someone called Clark sent that in. And I think I might have said something similar to that barely seconds ago on this very podcast. The phrase, did you see what I did there? That's from Nigel Lovell, as is yes, I'm going there / yes, I went there. And this is something, okay, Alan Fletcher spotted this one. He submitted it. This is something I've definitely done in the past and spotted and tried to get rid of. But using a deliberate innuendo in a story followed by, not like that, you pervert, you made it dirty, not me, brackets, chuckles as if to say, what am I like? There's an awful lot of that around. Any reference to living the dream? That's Brian Cant has apparently sent that one in. I wonder if that's the real Brian Cant or simply a real Brian Cant. Alex Perry has also suggested this is happening, which he points out is one of several lines regularly borrowed from Nick Helm. It's a very good point. Nick has a certain sort of energy and a particular attack, a particular approach to it that I think is going to see him imitated to a Kitson-esque level. So I think a lot of these, I've always thought that Boom and Strap In originated with Kitson, but perhaps you could email in and prove me wrong. It's info@comedianscomedian.com. And by now, all the links to all of my guests will be up on the blog, which is comedianscomedian.com/blog. So if you're looking for video footage or the website or the Facebook page of someone that I've had on the show, those should all be up there by now. I've made a little video ad for the show to submit to blogs and advertise the show around the place, try and get people in, for example, America, interested. It features interviews with Eddie Pepitone, Josh and Hannibal Buress. It's just a little a minute-long thing. So if you know of any other comedy publications I should be submitting it to, do give me a shout. Send us an email. You can, of course, follow me on Twitter @comcompod, and you can link to the Facebook page from comedianscomedian.com. So there's all manner of stuff. Whatever your particular social media addiction, you can find out things. And I try to put up little special things up there from time to time, make it worthwhile. Finally, the beeps at the end. We do a question-answer session with Josh at the end of this show, and the little beeps that I've put in there are just where I've replaced inaudible questions, just so we're not sort of sat listening to minutes of silence while people get their points across. So that is all the stuff I have to tell you for now. I hope you enjoy the rest of this one. As I said, I really enjoyed doing it, and I'm off now to go and interview the guest for next week, which is going to be Addy van der Borg. So can't wait for that. Here's Josh. So where were we? In the making of this show, you started off with some topics. So what were your starting points that have become the most successful bits of this?
There's a bit about board games. That's a successful bit. There's a bit... so that Cocoa Pops thing, that's the first 10 minutes really now.
Sure, okay.
And the other thing that will often happen is you'll have other little ideas that maybe don't work in their own right that well. So, for instance, I've got a bit about... I mean, this sounds dreadful, out of context.
that's what we're here for.
So I've got a bit about chemists selling tights.
Okay.
Issues. And it never really worked because it would just be, what's that really in there for? But then on the Cocoa Pops thing, you've got that thing about that's a cash point offering you Cocoa Pops. That's a business broadening out to do something that you shouldn't do. And... if you do the chemist bit off that, it suddenly makes it all the more stronger because it's part of it then.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I'm struggling very slightly with a cash point offering you Cocoa Pops. How on earth is that possible?
I was at a cash point and I got a question on the cash point saying, are you considering buying Cocoa Pops today? With the option
in
to
what
yes
city
or no.
Were you standing when this happened?
London town.
Really?
And,
okay.
Yeah. And, So it's absurd.
Sure.
Obviously. So there's a whole bit off that and jokes about that. And then it's one of the key things you can do is it's like.
Yes, of course.
And that when you go into the chemist bit off it, the chemist bit that wasn't actually that strong suddenly becomes really strong because it looks like it's got a reason for existing.
Yes. And it makes the initial jokes look like a casual setup for
the
thing you're
exactly.
actually going to talk about.
Yeah. So you. the two weaker bits can together be stronger than the sum of their parts. Mm-hmm. I do, both years with Edinburgh, I've kind of had worked with John Gordillo on just, he's come to watch the show and talked to me about it. And he's amazing. But he's really good at a lot of stuff. The strength is how you go into it. Mm-hmm. So people need, you have to have a, I mean, there's obviously my stuff is frivolous and there's no emotion, mm-hmm. really, but you do have to have that emotional core,
yeah.
of why are you talking about this? There has to be a reason.
You are very strong on attitude,
yeah,
aren't you? That's, I mean, you have that kind of, I think I could see a thing in life and I would know how the persona of Josh Widdicombe feels about that thing.
Yeah, and
so that's a really strong...
Do you know what? That's luck that I worked out that I've ended up doing that. Mm. But I think that's actually one of the strong things that I've managed to do somehow. Mm-hmm. Fluke more than anything.
Okay.
A lot of comedians can do a pretty passable impression of me.
Yeah.
And
And that's a testament almost to how strong your persona is.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very good...
That's good.
That's
one of the, that should be one of the rules. Russell Brand said, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before, said that if you want to be a famous comedian, you should have a recognisable silhouette to get really famous. And if you think about it, that works with a lot of famous people. And it works because that thing then becomes the imprint of that person. And I think in a similar way, if someone can do an impression of you, chances are you're doing it right because you're distinct enough. You can do it. I think I'm probably quite difficult to do an impression
of. I tell you, something weird that happened is someone showed me a video, obviously I'm not going to say who it is, of a new comic that really sounded like me.
Wow.
And it was really odd.
Okay. There's a lot of tradition of doing that. Jeremy Hardy says that when he started, he was basically a Norman Lovett tribute act.
I was a Stuart Lee tribute act when I started. Look at me now.
Yeah, okay. Look at you now, smiling and giggling away. Yeah.
Yeah, because you find what you... Do you know what? Once you find your angle...
Yeah.
You can... It's kind of like a machine, isn't it? You go... like a process of... you go, here's the subject matter. What would I think of that?
Yes.
And it's quite... Like, if you... I was going to say this.
Yes, so this is the Cambridge thing.
Yeah, I Nish, who's here, Nish Kumar...
Nish Kumar, currently on at the Nish.
Hello.
Where and when are you on? That was a plug for you.
8:20 at the Daisy Room.
8:20 at the Daisy Room, ladies and gentlemen. Josh.
We'll edit that one out. we went to Cambridge together to do a gig, and Nish was doing an impression of me, as per usual. And it was quite interesting because we were on a train and we were both kind of playing a game where we'd talk about any subject as if I was talking about it on stage.
Gotcha, okay.
And Nish was going, it's a piece of piss what you do.
really easy. Could we ask Nish to briefly reprise his impression?
Yeah.
Come on. Ladies and gentlemen, cameo appearance from Mr. Nish Kumar. We'd like... I think the fairest way to do this would be if there was a suggestion of a topic from the audience, something for Nish to do stand-up as Josh Widdicombe. Subject matter? The Olympics. It's Josh, come and take a mic. This is Nish Kumar.
Well, can I just say that if any of this is... I own the copyright to any of this.
This impression has been wildly overstated.
Into the mic, please. We're recording this forever.
The quality of my impression of Josh has been wildly overstated.
Yeah, it's not about the quality. It's about the tone that you're going for with the impression. So it doesn't matter if this isn't funny. This is an experiment, not a routine.
That's what I say at the beginning of my show as well. In fairness. So this is Josh talking about the Olympics. Yeah, the important thing with Josh is that whatever you say, it has to culminate in the use of the phrase, I mean, who is at the Olympics? Who is watching the Olympics alone, sitting there watching athletes? Who is doing that?
Nish Kumar, ladies and gentlemen. There we are.
It's quite good.
Bit of context there. Yeah. Yeah, so he's got you've got a memorable voice, and that's would you say that's true to the Josh Widdicombe angle?
Yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah, yeah. Of course it is, because it's it is, and it's quite weird because obviously it's difficult I've only been going a few years, so I don't know whether you're. The difference between comedy and music is with a band like, for instance, Radiohead, mm-hmm. they consciously reinvent themselves. I mean, now they're rubbish, but they constantly kind of, certainly Kid A, for instance, that is them going, or Blur is it? Blur's probably a better example. They go, yeah. Now we're this, now we're this, now we're this. And no one goes, whoa, 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 whoa. No, you're the guys.
Pick one.
Yeah. But with comedy, you are kind of, because it's more that you are that person.
Yes.
You are actually.
You're
that
supposed
comedian.
To be telling the truth. Yeah, the truth isn't allowed to change.
You couldn't have Rod Gilbert come out and do his happy show. It wouldn't work at all.
Absolutely, that's a good point.
You kind of, when you're a comedian, by the time you get locked in to TV, that's who you are, I think.
Okay.
And that's the prod. Want of a better word, that is the product that you're selling, is this kind of stand-up. Mm-hmm. And doing new shows, you're trying to make it better, and you're trying to kind of twist it and make it more interesting. But essentially, you're doing what you do.
Yes.
Because that's what people have paid money for. And I think people have bought into who you are far more than they have with a band. So while a band can reinvent themselves, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I'm lacking ambition, but I don't understand really how I would go about changing my persona now.
Yes, of course. Yeah,
it can evolve. For example, I saw Jack D in Kilkenny a few months ago, and Jack D is older, obviously. He can't avoid that. But he's still Jack D. He's still got to be Jack D. He can't suddenly go, do you know what? Since the kids have moved out, I've got a new perspective on this. So... you've got
even if he does have that perspective, even if his persona that he developed 30 years ago
exactly.
was true then, and he's changed now.
I didn't really know him. I met him and spent a bit of time with him over there, and he's just a really nice, normal, nice guy.
Yeah.
He's not going, oh, for crying out loud, what's wrong with this coffee? Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
So... You are kind of locked in, I think. Mm-hmm. But that's good, because if I go and see Dylan Moran, I want to see Dylan Moran.
Yes.
I don't want to see...
Hey!
Yeah,
actually,
else.
Things are all right, and I'm stone cold sober.
Yeah.
that's part of the act. I'm not slagging him off there. I'm not having a go. His act is he drinks wine throughout. Yeah.
Yeah. So you that's definitely what you want, isn't it? Because if you had... Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. So you were saying about the
Cambridge
example.
It's like that thing where you go, you're almost putting my character in different situations and going, how would he react to this? And it is
absolutely.
Me. It's not a character I've built up. It's, have you read Frank Skinner's autobiography?
Yes, I have, yeah.
There's that really good bit, I always kind of end up saying this, but where he says, it's not that you're not the person on stage, it's you're... a version, and it's the version where some things are turned up to 11 and some aspects are turned down to 1. It's a very two-dimensional form, stand-up. You've got to be quite a two-dimensional character. There's not that much ability to change or any of that, really. Mm. You're a cartoon, essentially.
Mm.
And then when you're writing the material, you're going, right, so what would... happen if...
In the comic strip of Josh Widdicombe walking into...
It's almost like,
oh
my God, now he's in a supermarket.
Yes,
how's
okay.
this going to play out?
Yes.
I should write that down. But, does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. It resonates as well with a thing in clowning, which is that in kind of theatre clowning, as opposed to circus red-nosed clowning, but, you know, physical comedy, clowning is all about... There's a woman called Angela De Castro who teaches clown, a famous clown teacher. Angela De Castro uses the example of imagining a conference in your head of all of the different aspects of your personality around a conference table, and it's about letting one of them speak.
Yeah.
And kind of saying, okay, you know, I myself am true and myself, but like on stage, I might particularly play to the lascivious me and the kind of simpering me. And those are the...
Because it is, I'm sure, I mean, you've spent time with me and I'm sure Nish would agree with this. There is that... I'm certainly that
You don't
guy.
Walk around fed up with everything.
No, but I can lose... I can get annoyed, but...
Yes. I think I know how you would react to a lot of things. Yeah. I'd go, oh, Josh isn't going to like this.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a monster. A monster.
But I couldn't be that guy the whole time. I'd be a fucking nightmare to live with. Yeah.
This is actually an intervention. And so you were telling me before about with this incident.
Do you know what's
in the
interesting,
Cambridge?
Actually? Just going off on a...
Go on.
Is when you do panel shows, suddenly that's a really interesting kind of... Oh, so I've got to take this character and I've got to be on... Now I'm in this situation. How does... And it's quite... I don't know how to do it yet, really.
Yes.
Okay. How I'm meant to behave. And you get better every time.
You need to play with others as well. You need to know how Josh Widdicombe reacts to Frankie Boyle.
Yeah, terrified. I've never met him.
But that kind of chemistry, you need to work out. That's like everyone is doing their clown, their cartoon character.
Yeah, and that's why, say, the people that get really good on panel shows, people like, just people who nail how to adapt to it, to Milton Jones, totally worked out what Milton Jones would do on a panel.
Yes.
If Milton Jones was put in that situation, what would he do? And he's worked that out.
Yes.
Whereas, I mean, I've had some bad ones, and I can tell you, suddenly you don't know who you are. You're sat there going, I don't know
whose side to take. I don't know what I'm meant to disagree with.
And when it goes, you're yourself, but it's really good. Mm. But
and that's the one bit that makes it
almost like
TV.
A test. It's almost like a test of the strength of who you are as a character. Does it stand up to this scrutiny now?
Mm.
If you put it in this situation. It's quite interesting I talk about it in the third person, isn't it? Because... as if it's not me, but it is. And I don't know, does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. I was interested to hear that when you tried doing material on stage that you and Nish had made up, it didn't work.
Didn't work.
Talk to me about that.
I can't remember what we came up with. What was it, Nish? Was it about cherry tomatoes? which I still think and it was about perching. I had this thing we talked about when you perch on a, when you're, I've tried it quite a few times, it's never worked, about it, when a sofa's full and you'll perch on the arm.
Yeah.
And you'll always, how you'll always say, I'm fine, I'll perch.
Yeah.
And I thought this is, and it just didn't really go anywhere or work. And the thing about, and so there was that. And we, doing it on the train, we were like, yeah, of course this works. Because we were riffing off it. And the cherry tomatoes thing about how when you get in a salad, like a Tesco or whatever salad, M&S, you get a full cherry tomato and how difficult it is to eat it, how you have to stab it and then or it explode in your mouth if you don't stab it first. And it did seem like, I don't know, is that right, Nish?
Yeah.
And it did seem at the time like this is exactly the tone. You can imagine it.
And
it's exactly the kind of... Because what I really like to talk about is take it down to the real minutiae. That's where it's funniest for me. My favourite comedy, my favourite thrill, for want of a better word, of watching comedy is when someone totally nails a real minutiae of... human experience.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Walsh is brilliant at that. So, and it's really exciting because a lot of people have a go at observational comedy, and it's really weird that I think that it's a whipping boy, because I think,
It's so hard to notice a thing that everyone has noticed, but they haven't noticed that they've noticed
it. Yeah, and then people go, well, it's obvious. It's not obvious.
Yeah, sure.
It's really difficult, actually, to find something that is in that Venn diagram between too obvious or not too obvious and too not tapping into human
experience. Have you heard Seinfeld's example about the cliffs?
Yeah,
So Seinfeld says a joke is a jump from one cliff to another. And if the two cliffs are close together, if they're too close together, then you make it easily. And if they're too far apart, then you don't make it. And either way, the joke doesn't work. You have to, for the joke to work, you have to just make it. And
take the audience.
Yeah, but it's just a really useful way to talk about comedy. It's a really useful way to analyse it, because you can look at a joke and go, well, you know, the problem with this joke is the cliffs are too close together.
Yeah.
So you can set about moving them apart.
So I saw Seinfeld when he came.
Oh, okay.
I didn't go to the O2. I saw him the night before he did the Comedy Store.
Oh, wow. So. Okay.
Actually, as an aside on that.
Go on,
weird.
Let's have it.
I turned up to watch it because Roisin Conti had texted me and said, come down to the Comedy Store, and I happened to be in Leicester Square. And I got there, and Charlotte from the store came up to me and said, Seinfeld's late. Can you go on and fill? So I had to do 10 minutes before Seinfeld.
Wow.
But anyway.
And the mark of you as a comic having class is that your poster this year doesn't say opened for Jerry Seinfeld. Very tempting to a lot of comedians.
What was I saying? He did a joke. He did the thing about weddings, and you're going, right, on the surface, a comedy snob would go, weddings, boring, no. Mm-hmm. But it's about identifying the thing that other people haven't identified. And if you can find something fresh in a topic that everyone knows, that's the best thing, isn't it? Because if you're talking about the books of Charles Bukowski, right, then for a start, you're alienating people.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because obviously other people are excited about that, but you want to be careful that you're not talking about that to make yourself look clever.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly, when I started out, had a real tendency for the first 2 years to think the nicheness of the topic was where the originality is.
Okay.
But I don't think it is the nicheness of the topic, because anyone can go, I'm going to do 5 minutes on Shed 7. Do you know what I mean? And no one's ever talked about them before.
Yeah.
And, but it's, I'd love to see it.
Niche.
I mean, who is going for gold? But anyone can choose that. That's not being original, because that is, it's also making it easier for yourself, because you have the whole palette of everything Shed 7 have ever done.
Yes, because no one's touched it before, yeah.
But if you're going, I'm going to talk about weddings, then you have to come up with some really good niche little topics on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just remember one joke that he did where he said about it's a rubbish party, because if you were to invite all these people to a party at any other time, who's coming to your party? Well, my gran, your auntie, I haven't seen you. And you're just going, well, that is an amazing.
Yes.
It's about that left turn that you're not expecting, but
yes,
you
well,
go
it's
with
art,
it.
Isn't it? It's obvious, but it's only obvious because he said it.
Yeah, exactly.
He's
and then people go.
Yeah.
Also, there's another thing where Seinfeld, for some reason, if Seinfeld was a British comic who did Live at the Apollo, everyone would have a go at him like they have a go at McIntyre. Mm. But for some reason, I don't think Seinfeld is any better than McIntyre. I think they're both very. I think they're both great.
Mm.
And for some reason, he has, I think it's because of his sitcom, clearly, credibility.
Yes, the people feel that like they know him.
Because you're watching it going, I bet you, if this wasn't Jerry Seinfeld doing this, all those people that harp on about observational comedy being easy would be saying this is easy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a bugbear of mine, clearly.
Let's talk about Stand Up for the Week, which you are a regular.
Nish's favourite programme.
Tell me about that. What are you referring to there?
Nish just loves it. Nish will mock me mercilessly about it.
Okay. That might be a useful way into the topic. Why is that? On what
well,
grounds?
I don't know, Nish. Why is it?
Because I'm jealous.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fine. All right.
Stand Up for the Week is a really interesting process to do, because you've got 3 days to do a 10-minute set.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of pressure because... but I've done 16 episodes now over two series. And it is amazing what you can do. And it does mean that, I think the reason, I almost had a breakdown in Edinburgh last year. I found it so stressful. Mm-hmm. I had a kind of 1,000-yard stare. I had a spot on the end of my nose for the whole festival that Verity, my agent, I used to have to put makeup on me before the gig, and it disappeared within 48 hours at the end of the festival. I found it that horrible and stressful.
Oh, my God.
And this year, I'm very relaxed about it. And I think part of that is because I've done stand-up for the week. I know that actually, you know, everything's all right. Everything can, yes. Everything will work out if you write. You can write this stuff. And so in the build-up, I was like, this is going to work, so it's fine.
So do you still suffer ever from... from a lack of confidence or self-consciousness.
You do.
So that didn't solve that problem. I found Show Me the Funny, writing...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a very similar process.
You know, writing like... this is a programme which none of you saw, which was...
Much like Stand Up for the Week.
where you had to go and you had to go to a specific place like the army, train with the army for 2 or 3 days, and then on the Thursday night you had to do a gig about the army to the army. And the rules were, which everyone adhered to, you had to do entirely new material. And I found as a result a very good thing that came out of that process was it made me go, oh, in my show now, oh, that bit needs a joke. I'll write a joke.
Yeah.
But I still am absolutely crippled. I'm better, but my crippling anxiety is still there.
Yes.
So skill itself has increased, but you still worry.
I think you have to have that. I think your main drive my main drive is... fear and negativity.
Sure.
And I think fear of it going wrong.
Yeah.
Negativity about how shit it is.
Mm-hmm.
Not being good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Being about to be found out.
Yeah.
Everything to come crashing down. I don't want to bring people down, but that is what drives me.
It's so easy. I've talked about this a lot before. Because we are effectively... Like our peers, people we know, people we've shared lifts with, are the best people in the country and some of the best people in the world at doing the thing we do. Mm. So imagine if you were like a plumber and you had to go to work with the best plumbers all the time. You'd probably be going, I don't know if I should be a plumber. I don't know if I'm okay with it.
Oh, yeah. But you get that with everyone. Rod Gilbert wrote about it in The Guardian yesterday. He did.
Okay.
For instance, I think John Richardson, for me, is one of the best comedians there is in the world. Well, not in the world. I don't know anything about outside of Britain. I'm very
refreshingly honest perspective in the world there.
Yeah. I'm very Anglo-centric in my taste, actually. Mm-hmm. Is Anglo all of Britain? Yeah. Yeah.
Anglo's English.
Well, all right, then all of Britain. I'm very Brito-centric in my tastes. But John Richardson, for instance... if you get the chance to see his show, which he's doing for 4 nights here. Did you see it in Mac?
Yes.
I think that's one of the best stand-up shows I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But having spent time with John, he thinks he's shit.
Yes.
Like I think I'm shit.
Yes.
And he thinks every week that his stuff on Stand Up for the Week isn't good enough. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And that is just a natural thing that... I think all comedians have, and I think it's a very healthy thing. I think if you think you're good...
There are comedians out there who think they're good. I'm thinking of one in particular who is very super positive to the extent that you suspect he or she, is a he, has read a book on...
Oh, yeah. If it's self-affirmation, the same one, I think he's got a Columbine in him.
We'll put some coded reference on the website later on to what we're talking about.
When someone's so positive, you think that is complete bullshit.
Yes,
you're going to snap. We'll edit that out.
It stayed dark. We haven't lightened the total.
But I do think like negativity is a very good way of.
Yes, Sarah Pascoe on Friday on the show
she's
was talking
negative.
About how... she's very positive in some ways, but she was talking about how every time she doesn't want to get up and do something or doesn't want to get her head down and work, she thinks of a specific person who bullied her, or out of several people who bullied her or were mean to her or said, you can't do it, and she goes to work to spite that person.
That's an unhealthy way to live.
Well, yeah, maybe. And Teller from Penn and Teller, he's said a thing online about how actually negativity can be a very positive force for work because we've all, you know, I'm not saying that there is necessarily truth to the tears of the clown stereotype.
I had this discussion recently. If you're in a happy... I'm now in quite a happy place in my life, which I've not been since I did stand-up. And what drives you then is a different thing, which is I want to get better at this so that I don't have to go and do this every night driving everywhere.
I want to be so good that you spend all your time.
I want to be so good that I'm doing it on my terms.
You spend all your time getting onto the circuit. Mark Watson told me this when I was very new. He said you spend all this time trying to get onto the circuit and get a regular income from gigging. And as soon as you do, the second you do, you go, how can I get off this?
Yeah, there's always that. You go, open mic. And do you know what? All the people that really enjoyed open mic, I never enjoyed open mic. It's absurd. You turn up.
That means working for free.
Oh, that's not why I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy it because the
gigs...
The gigs... So you start with these gigs, right? And they're in a pub in London and there's 8 people there and there's 15 acts doing 5 minutes each. And it's compared by someone who goes on and on.
Yeah.
Yeah, and is unhinged. And it goes on till... and it goes on till midnight. And
you have to do it.
And
there's
you have
no
to do
other
it.
Way to
and
be a comedian.
But I always thought I am trying to get better and get beyond this. Mm-hmm. And
and you make friends. There are positive aspects to it as well.
Yeah.
You all go through it together.
Yeah. Right? You've got to do it. It's great. But you are doing it to get on the circuit.
Yes.
And then I've got onto the circuit. And then you're... Yeah. The next thing is I've got to get off the circuit. Mm-hmm. And then you do Edinburgh. Or I don't, maybe not. But certainly for me, I do Edinburgh so that I... Because I don't want to do Edinburgh. I can't handle being here for a month. It does my head in. I like my house.
Yes.
And I don't know. I like to be in my house. And so I'm doing Edinburgh in the hope that I can do Edinburgh well enough that then I can maybe do a week in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And do it on my terms. And every time, there's always that next step. And that's the realisation with comedy. There's that dreadful moment when you realise there isn't an end.
Yeah.
There isn't a land of milk and honey. Do you know? Because I've worked
you're trying to try and get big enough so that you can stop.
But yeah. But I've worked now with a lot of the main comics in various ways.
Yeah.
So for instance, I've gigged with Michael McIntyre. Mm-hmm. He's still nervous. He's not going, this is a bloody...
I've made it.
Yeah, I can sit back and relax and do the O2 for 12 nights. He's going... I've got to do the O2. This has got to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's never an end game.
Mm.
Does that...
Absolutely. You have to set your own goals.
Is that the bleakest thing you've ever
heard? No, I think the way to survive that is you have to, and I'm not very good at doing this myself, but I think surely there has to be a way to survive it. And I think the way to survive it is to set yourself achievable, you know, high but realistic goals, things that you want but don't need to make you happy, and make those things happen. And you seem to be doing that.
Yeah, you've just got to... I mean, maybe it's luck more than judgment, but you've just got to try and do those things to... I mean, to make it very clear, that's not to say that there's anything wrong with people who enjoy the... Yeah, there are people, sure. There are hobbyists that will do open mic, and that is great.
And there are people that love coming to the festival every year.
Yeah, there are people that love Edinburgh.
Yeah.
But I can't deal with it psychologically, so I have to... And there are people that love doing the Friday and Saturday night clubs, but I find it stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to play your own game in that sense, don't you? Mm.
Let's, if I can just cut you off slightly, we've only got about 15 minutes left. This has flown by. I'd like to talk to you about writing specifically. You brought a notebook with you, and then you revealed to me it's a notebook that you have faked up because you didn't bring your real notebook.
Well, I forgot to bring my notebook to Edinburgh because obviously I thought the show's written.
Yes.
So I got a new notebook, and then I can't write in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'll tell you what I'll do. This will be a good exercise. I'll just write a new bit of material that I can show Stuart, but
it didn't work. Fine, okay, but show us what you did get.
But what basically it shows the process I'll do is...
Exactly.
Say you get a subject matter. So, for instance, I've chosen mistletoe as the subject matter, which I'm sure Nish would agree is...
classic Widdicombe.
Classic Widdicombe. The reason I've chosen that is I had a dream that Steve Bennett had written in a review we want to see Widdicombe talk about things like mistletoe. And I thought, quite interesting.
This is wonderful. Quite if you do it and it becomes part of your next show, Steve reviews it, he's heard this, it all becomes some sort of vortex.
We've all had these situations where you dream a joke and you think, fucking awesome, yeah, and then you wake up and it's shit.
Yeah.
But that's actually, I woke up and I thought, yeah, I reckon I could write about mistletoe. Yeah, yeah. That's quite an interesting area.
Okay.
So I start with classic spider diagram. I like a spider diagram.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just think of anything off it. And then I'll tend to try something as a very, very shortened version of it.
Okay.
So I'll drop it in a gig. Throughout the year, every gig, in my view, you should be trying stuff every gig.
Yes.
Unless it's an important gig.
Yes.
But, for instance, if I'm doing the 99 Club in London on a Tuesday night for £60, to lose my Tuesday night, it has to...
You've got to make something
I've got
more
to
than £60,
move forward
haven't you?
As a comedian.
Yeah.
Otherwise, otherwise I'd work in a bar for 60 quid. Do you know what I mean? If I'm going to go that far, I've got to try and improve my set every time I do it and try something. So I just do mistletoe off, say, I've got a bit about buttercups, for instance, and shining them under another child's chin. Yeah. I could easily go, right, well, tonight I'll do that buttercup bit and then I'll just segue into the mistletoe bit, try two jokes, and you get an instant feel as to whether it's something the audience will get on board with and want you to talk about.
Yeah.
And if you get a positive, then you can go back and you can build it up and try and make it bigger and slowly bigger. And what I tend to do is I'll write it out like this, which obviously isn't very good for a podcast, is it? But so you'll have... I never write full swathes of prose because I don't think that identifies where the punchlines are.
That's a really good point. That's a trap I get caught in a lot, is writing out, you know, typing, in fact, longhand. And just while we're on the subject, you write in a notebook. Do you ever type? Do you ever...
No, I don't really want... I think the internet is too distracting.
Yes, okay.
And I think it's just more romantic, isn't it, to do it in a notebook? So what I'll do, because you get the feel for the punchlines, you'll go, say... maybe a better example is to use something I've got, right? So let's take this buttercup
bit.
Okay, so you go... You've got the line in, which is when you're a child... obviously, this isn't going to be funny in context, so don't laugh politely. When you're a child, you're told these things that are myths, like if you hold a buttercup underneath another child's chin, it reflects back. And then I'll do an arrow off it. This is the first punchline. So you go, correct me if I'm wrong, if you're that close to them, just ask.
Right. and to then, determine whether they like butter.
Yeah, that's yeah. And then you go, no one's keeping that information to themselves. And then you'll do an act out. So that's like one punchline, just ask. Act out, second punchline.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a string. And then you'll go...
And by act out, so again, terminology.
Oh, it's like you'll play out the situation. It's a very easy way. You should I'll do an arrow down and along like that. Does that... Mm-hmm. Is that clear? And then... You can see also there where you can add sort of things that aren't long enough strings. So you think there's probably more punchlines. I'll always try and get as many punchlines in the string as possible.
Yeah, okay.
Because to layer it, it gets...
That's fascinating structurally, because absolutely, as you say, you can see this has only really got two jokes in it.
Yeah,
but
yeah, exactly.
You can see very quickly if you go ding, 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 ding. Yeah, that's...
So you'll go line, one joke, two joke, and then you might go back to it and kind of start another string, because it's quite easy to do that, because that's how chat goes. So you'd go, buttercup, ask them, act out, and then I'll do a thing. No one's being interrogated about whether they... no one's keeping that information themselves.
Yeah.
Someone being interrogated at Guantanamo Bay. All right. Act out.
Yeah.
And there's three jokes off that. So there's a joke where you'll go, he's not cracking, fetch the buttercup. And then I'll go, don't worry, he's going, no, we've got him tied down with a daisy chain.
Yeah.
And then you go, how long has he been here? Let me just check by blowing the seeds off this dandelion. So you've got these extra topper jokes. And when you layer them, it's really satisfying.
Yes.
But also, by doing it with arrows and having it... And you only need... You wouldn't write, let me just check by... You just write arrow, dandelion.
Yes.
Because you should... By speaking it, you'll find the correct phrasing. A lot of people think I write quite specifically phrasing-wise, but I don't really. I'll just...
But you write, it's almost like the structure that's specific.
Yeah, and then you should find the right phrasing by performing it, because I tell you what I don't like is when you hear... the reason, for instance... I mean, I think Stuart Lee is brilliant, but the reason I prefer John Richardson to Stuart Lee as an experience of watching is I think John Richardson is as good a writer, but he doesn't flaunt it. And I don't... Okay. I really like acts that you go, this feels so natural and conversational. There doesn't feel like there's any artifice. I don't want to feel like it's written.
Having the working out exposed.
Yeah,
there's a bit of a vogue, isn't there, for showing this is the structure.
But definitely, you certainly get that a lot on the open mic circuit.
Yes, yes. Well, that's come up on the podcast several times about how people will say things like that deserve more, or you know, they'll sort of expose the workings out. But it's quite an immature thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah,
because everyone's doing it for a start.
I want it to feel completely
like I grinds my teeth to powder whenever anyone kind of goes, "Oh, that was a callback."
Yeah, because you're just going...
that's an industry bit of terminology which you wouldn't even necessarily understand what it meant. And seeing someone pointing it out is very frustrating.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know what it is, I think? I think it all comes out of... Because particularly in the last 5 years, stand-up's become a bit shiny floor suit. For want of a better word, square. So I think there's almost an embarrassment amongst young people to do stand-up because it's... So they will...
Alternative has now become mainstream and now new alternative is seizing on things like...
There's this need to prove that you aren't a smiley person off the TV, which, you know, fair enough. But I think that a lot of that dissection of it comes of trying to go, no, I'm not like these guys. I'm not like John Bishop or whoever.
Sure.
Which I don't really understand why you do that, but fair enough. But where was I? I can't remember what I was saying.
So, lines coming off them, act out. We were looking at the...
One. So you just... that's what I was saying. I will try and get the phrasing by saying it on stage because then it feels more natural. Mm-hmm. And I like it to feel like a natural conversation that's really funny rather than... I think it's really bad when someone will flaunt their writing and have... I mean, Dylan Moran's a good example of someone who... I don't know how he writes, obviously, but obviously he's got very vivid and verbose. But it still feels natural. At no point do you go, he's written this and
you don't get
it.
A visual picture of him sitting working.
Yeah, and I don't want that. I want it to feel like this is a man talking about a subject.
I'm just going to repeat that for the sake of the recording. So there was a question about how you remember... if you don't have a great memory, what sort of techniques do you use to remember 50 minutes worth of stuff?
I don't use any kind of memory techniques, but just through previewing it a lot, I'll preview with notes and then the notes will get more and more shorter and just be terms. And it's quite boringly. I'm not a walk around the house rehearsing kind of guy.
Okay.
And I know I should be because... That would make me a much better comedian.
Every time
I find it really difficult to do.
It's so weird and difficult to do a gig in your room to no one, but every time when I've done that during the day before a preview, I've gone on to have a much better preview.
I know. It does my head in that I won't do
it. It's too weird. It's just
and
really...
do you know what? Every year, every September, I'll go, right, this year, that's what I'm going to do. And I don't know. I just can't do it.
You don't have mnemonic techniques or
no. I don't.
Like that.
No, you end up, you start with a bit, and they'll be smaller, and then if you bolt them together, at the end you'll go Cocoa Pops, and then you'll know that bit.
Yeah, but if it's conversational enough, it will flow.
Yeah, it does just flow, and I don't know. There's no real skills I could point to, other than. Just gig a lot and you will remember it. And you just doing bits until it's starting to go wrong, then you dap out and then it will just build.
Yeah.
But that's why I couldn't write a show in July. Some people can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, knock it together. I have to do it throughout the year.
Anyone else? I hope that answers your question. So you've been 18 months on the open mic circuit and the idea of sitting down and doing the writing. Sure. That's not necessarily right or wrong.
Yeah, I would definitely say that I think the worst thing people do when they're giving tips on comedy is to presume that their way is the right way. Because that's the way I work. But genuinely, you just have that everyone will work in a different way. There's and you have to just try and work out what is the best way for you to work, because there's no way that you can it's quite difficult to pick up working methods from other people. I think it's just trial and error.
I'm sure at one point I was hoping that this series of podcasts and live shows
create a definitive
would turn me
way.
Into a, like, I could form up into a giant robot made out of techniques. Doesn't
no
really
I don't
really
I genuinely work. Can't think of many people who've given me told me about their working methods and I've implemented them.
Yes.
I think you just kind of evolve yourself, and it's kind of a disappointing fudge of an answer, because the fact is, this is one of the things you find, is there's no secrets.
Yeah.
There's no, the top people don't know anything.
No, they just work
really hard. And so there's nothing like, by the way, when you get your first paid 20,
when you're a level
we take you inside and tell you how it's done.
£20,000.
Yeah.
You just on the subject of hard work and discipline, I heard a rumour from your housemate Tom Crane that you wrote for 8 hours a day.
Yeah, that's rubbish.
Where has that come from? I've been saying that almost every
episode.
Because
he's quite lazy. Okay. He's not lazy, but he works in a different way to me.
Yeah.
So he will work on a laptop open, with his emails open, on Facebook, half working kind of way. I have to kind of sit at a table.
But do you do a certain number of hours a day?
No. Well, it depends, obviously. If I have a day where I haven't got to do anything, and it's a Monday to Friday, then I will get up and I will try and work from 10, half 10, till lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And
so the people with real jobs there laughing at you.
And then lunch will invariably make me tired.
And, it's a killer, isn't it?
Yeah. I need to eat more soup and less carbs. Carbs are a real negative.
Do you do any other work? Do you do any admin? Just in a typical one of
not
those days?
I've got a lot less admin since I've got an agent, obviously. So she'll do a lot of my admin for me, Flo. She'll there'll be phone calls, but I don't have to invoice. I don't have to book my own life.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast.
Diary. Tom, for instance, has to book his own live diary, and I think it's stuff like that. Do you know what? The best thing that happened to me about getting an agent was, and everyone goes on and on about, when you're on the open mic circuit, you think that's the key to being great is to have an agent. It's rubbish. That's not the key at all. And people just want an agent so they can say they've got an agent. And so the people will sign to these companies that won't do anything for you. But what I like about the situation I've got is they'll do everything for me. So they'll book the hotel, they'll tell me, they'll do the diary, they'll invoice, I'll get them.
So you
money.
Don't need to think about
so
anything
I can
apart
just
from
think
writing
about,
jokes.
And they've never ever given me a note or a tip on my writing.
Yeah.
It's a very good line there, that business, that's creativity. And so that buys me a lot of time, because I think if I was booking my own live diary, it's a tiring thing. That takes it out of you. You feel like you've done a day's work.
It's an opportunity for distractions as well, isn't it? You've got to be online emailing.
Could write that, but maybe I should send off a few emails.
Yeah, that is tricky. So it's funny, in fact.
I've got lucky in that sense.
One of the ways in which being an open spot is harder sometimes is you've got to fit it around the rest of your life.
And you've got a job.
We've got time. I think we'll do one last question, then I think we're going to get kicked out of the room. So last question there, and I'll repeat it. If you hated the open mic circuit so much, what was your motivation for sticking with it?
I hated working in office more. And do you know what? The main motivation was I started in January 2008, and I got off to quite a good start for 6 to 8 months, and then I came to Edinburgh and had a terrible month and lost my confidence completely. And I might have quit, but I also split up with my girlfriend of 6 years. Mm-hmm. And mainly because I'd done too much comedy, I think.
Common problem.
And I thought, well, I can't lose that and then not come out of it as a comedian. So I've got to see this through to the bitter end. Because otherwise I've lost everything. Yeah. So if that's, to be honest, split up with your girlfriend.
And on that note, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much, worries. Josh. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Mr. Josh Whittacombe. So that was Josh. As I said, I thought that was a really invigorating conversation. I really got a lot of respect for Josh, and thanks very much to him for coming on the show. Next episode will be Addy van der Borg. That will be coming out next Wednesday. And so do, if you've got any Australian suggestions, I'm going to start building a list now of people in the Southern Hemisphere that I'd like to interview when I'm over there next year. And also thanks to Nish Kumar, who turned up briefly in that episode. He's not an impressionist, but he could do a mean Josh Whittacombe. Nish does his own comedy work. He's a fabulous comic in his own right, and I'm going to be getting him on the show, I think, in January next year, maybe first week of January. He's booked in. In the meantime, you can follow him at Mr. Nish Kumar. That's MRNISHKUMAR. And that's all the stuff for today. Thank you very much for listening. As ever, I hope you get either to your gigs or back home from your gigs safely, or if you're staying up all night making cakes, as one listener tweeted me, then I hope your dough has risen. Cakes aren't made of dough. Christ's sake. Bye.
I mean, who is at the Olympics?
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.